Good morning. I'm Leslie Thatcher. 8:06 on this Monday morning. It's May 5th, and currently we've got 41 degrees here in Old Town Park City under mostly cloudy skies. Heber City reporting 45 degrees. On the phone with us from the ABC Forecast Center, meteorologist Cedric Haynes. Good morning.
Good morning, Leslie. Yeah, we've got another day with a quiet start to the day, but as we go throughout the day, we do expect things to become a little more active. We're going to be seeing scattered showers and a couple of rumbles of thunder developing as we go throughout the afternoon hours here in Park City. We'll see high temperatures only climbing into the mid-50s, but we'll climb into the low 60s there in the Heber Valley. Still a below-average day with that increasing chance of scattered showers and rumbles as we go throughout this afternoon. Tonight, we'll continue to keep that chance of showers around across the area as we see moisture pivoting in from the low pressure down to our south. That's going to mean unsettled conditions sticking around through tonight. Now, in the Heber Valley, we're expecting temperatures to drop down to around 40 degrees, but in Park City, we can see those temperatures getting down into the low to mid 30s. So that means that not only can we see some rain showers, we may even see a few snow showers mixing in with those rain showers late tonight. Not expecting much, if any, accumulation, but just a sign that, hey, even though it's May, we are still tracking that chance from time to time of seeing some of that rain, snow mix out there across the area. Now, as you head over towards the Uintas, that's where you could see some accumulations developing later tonight. Otherwise, as we go into the day on your Tuesday, look for off and on chances of more scattered showers and a couple of rumbles of thunder to develop. High temperatures once again in Park City back into the mid-50s. We'll be in the low 60s for highs in the Heber Valley. But we've got some good news. We do expect some drier conditions to begin to build in by Wednesday. So we'll call it partly cloudy skies for your Wednesday. There will be a chance of an isolated shower or two in the afternoon, but definitely drier conditions compared to our Monday and Tuesday. High temperatures will be a little warmer as well. Upper 50s to near 60 in Park City, and we should top out into the mid to upper 60s in the Heber Valley. As we get towards the end of the work week, we've got more changes as we see sunshine and a high pressure ridge or heat dome building in across the area. And that's going to mean dry conditions. It's also going to mean much warmer conditions building into the area. So as we go into your Thursday, we're looking at lots of sunshine, morning low temperatures, starting off in the upper 30s in the Heber Valley, the low 40s there in Park City. And we'll see our highs climbing into the mid-60s by the afternoon hours with high temperatures into the low to mid-70s as we get towards the afternoon hours on your Thursday. Now, Friday, we're looking at lots of sunshine, just a beautiful wrap-up to the work week here with high temperatures in the low 70s in Park City. And we'll see those highs in the mid to upper 70s in the Heber Valley with that sunshine. So some beautiful weather to close out the week. As we head into the weekend, we continue with at least mostly sunny to partly cloudy skies. We'll start to notice a little more humidity returning across the area. Yeah, we haven't used that word in a while. And we'll see those morning temperatures starting off in the 40s with highs in the mid-70s in Park City on Saturday and Sunday. But get this, high temperatures in the Heber Valley right around the 80-degree mark. So we've got some much warmer and nicer conditions on the way, but it's going to take until the middle of the week before it arrives, Leslie.
Okay, thank you, Cedric. Well, stay tuned. Coming up on the local news hour, I'll be checking in with Summit County Sheriff Frank Smith along with PIO Skylar Talbot. Later on, Heber City Manager Matt Brower calling in to preview Tuesday's City Council meeting. And finally in the hour, Utah Film Director Robin Hauser will be joined by COO of She Money, Madison Lemansky, discussing the new documentary Thaw. This is screening at the Jim Santee Auditorium on Wednesday, the 5th. There's going to be a pre-screening reception followed by a post-film moderated panel. Park City leaders have invited state transportation officials to get more involved in High Valley Transit's plan to add dedicated bus lanes to State Route 224. KPCW's Parker Malatesta reports.
Two liaisons from the Park City Council, Jeremy Rubel and Bill Sirocco, recently met with Utah Department of Transportation officials to express concerns about its level of involvement in High Valley Transit's bus rapid transit project. Rubel said the state agency is now eager to take a greater role.
The good news is that UDOT was enthusiastic about the opportunity to be more involved and work together on the project. And that's in my opinion, and speaking to you as a liaison who was in that meeting, a very good thing for the Park City community.
Rubel said UDOT officials are open to listening to the city's concerns.
They're also open to right-sizing the project. They spoke about the need to have the project be context-sensitive to our rural environment.
In a statement to KPCW, High Valley Transit Executive Director Caroline Rodriguez said, quote, UDOT has been deeply involved in this project since its inception, and we're pleased that they will continue to provide their support and expertise. Sirocco said the city's goal isn't to stop High Valley Transit.
This was never about derailing the project. It was about doing the right thing for Park City. And I feel like we've come to a really good place on that.
He said increased collaboration with UDOT could also help as the city looks to identify a transit solution for State Route 248. Park City Council members previously expressed concerns about the plan for State Route 224, which is owned and managed by the state. It involves widening SR 224 by about 10 feet to add dedicated bus lanes on each side of the road that connects Park City proper with Kimball Junction. Council members have said the road widening could harm the quality of life for residents and pose a serious risk for wildlife, which have repeatedly been killed in vehicle collisions on SR 224. They have suggested the road widening should not include areas within city limits, which begin at the McPullen Barn. Existing traffic data shows that the most significant congestion on SR 224 occurs between Canyons Village and Kimball Junction outside of Park City. High Valley Transit previously said it plans to begin staging work for the Bus Rapid Transit project this fall. The goal is to complete most of the construction by the end of 2027. Park City Municipal is a financial supporter of KPCW. Parker Malatesta, KPCW News.
Joining us in the studio with an update from the Summit County Sheriff's Office, Sheriff Frank Smith, along with Public Information Officer Skylar Talbot. Good morning.
Good morning. How are you?
Great. Frank, KPCW is still trying to piece together the investigations that may or may not have taken place into how Park City School District employees were paid, what sort of special assignment contracts were issued, and whether the former superintendent's contract that provided for automatic renewal and gave her severance pay twice as long as was whether or not that contract was lawfully approved. So did the Sheriff's Department do an investigation on any of this?
No, it wasn't in our jurisdiction. It was in Park City Police Department's jurisdiction. However, when I spoke to Chief Carpenter, we both agreed that an outside third-party law enforcement agency should look into this. And we asked the Attorney General's office to do it. So every lead that came, at least to my office, was passed to the Attorney General's office. And the reason we did that was you're kind of in a no-win situation when you have another public entity that everyone knows in law enforcement, and we wanted to be fair. If we convicted someone, they would say that we railroaded them, and if we gave them a pass or found that there wasn't enough probable cause to move forward an investigation, they would say that we did it because they're friends. So we thought it was prudent to bring in a third party, which was the Attorney General's office, and they did a thorough investigation and thought it wasn't prosecutable.
Yeah, my understanding, what did the AG's office look at, though, and what information was given to the AG's office for them to look at?
You know, from the Sheriff's office, there was one witness that came forward that I personally spoke to, and we had a third-party friend, and he felt very comfortable speaking to me. We passed all that information to the Attorney General's office. We subsequently met, Chief Carpenter and I met with the Attorney General's investigators, with our lieutenants and captains, and passed all that information. And then they looked into it from there.
Yeah, but I guess what was that information that you passed on to the AG's office? Because my understanding is that you only forwarded on the information that you had gotten from the whistleblower, to find out more about how former COO Mike Tanner was using district property, facilities, staff to service and store his private vehicle while he was out of town. But it didn't have anything to do with some of the other issues that are still ongoing.
Yeah, that's incorrect. The whistleblower told us, because he was former military, about the manner in which Mike Tanner was either released from the service or was still a member and was possibly continuing service in another jurisdiction. Mm-hmm. And the Attorney General's office actually brought in an investigator from the Air Force who actually looked into that.
So that only had to do with his military service?
It had to do with him being on paid leave while he was supposedly doing military service. The allegation was he's already removed from the military, and that he was doing something else when he was in Chicago or whatever area he was in.
All right, so what investigative agency then looks into the other claims, again, about a contract that was offered to the former superintendent, again, that was basically not voted on, according to the chair of the president of the Park City School Board, telling me that she didn't vote on a contract that basically doubled her severance pay and created automatic renewals. I mean, that's one thing. What about the, you know, using taxpayer-funded facilities for and a school district employee to have vehicles serviced or stored? What about some of those allegations?
Yeah, so I heard about the, we didn't look into it. Again, it was Park City Police Department's case. They looked into the storage of the vehicle. I don't want to speak about their investigation because I won't be accurate, but I know that those allegations came forward. I know that they looked into them. The majority of that was passed to the Attorney General's office. As far as her pay, you know, that's a school board issue. I don't know what you would want us to investigate in that. The problem with this whole case, if this was clearly in the county, the school administration's offices were in the city, and Chief Carpenter is an extremely bright and prudent law enforcement official. He wouldn't let something move forward that was criminal that he would investigate.
All right, because I guess, I mean, we don't feel like local law enforcement has got involved once the AG's office said we've investigated and we haven't found anything prosecutable. But again, they looked at a very limited set of issues.
By limited, what exactly do you mean? Because everything that I knew from the broad spectrum the AG's office looked into, from the storage of the car to the time card issues to the travel issues, is there an issue that
Well, again, the superintendent's contracts, the special assignment contracts.
Listen, as a taxpayer and a citizen in this community, I'm appalled at that. But again, that was a school board issue. Someone in the school board voted on it. It never came to me as a law enforcement issue. As a taxpayer, I'm upset about the severance pay. I'm upset about the way that the children in this community were unfairly treated under Dr. Gilday's regime.
So it sounds like basically both the Summit County Attorney's was it ever referred to the Summit County Attorney's Office then? I mean, did they do their own investigation?
Well, they wouldn't do their own investigation. They would get the investigation from us and determine whether it was a prosecutable case or not. They would screen that case.
Yeah, and I guess that's what I'm saying. Why?
But they wouldn't, because it went to the Attorney General's office, who would screen it.
All right. So basically, the Summit County Sheriff's Office is washed its hands of the matter.
Well, that's not fair. We haven't washed our hands of the matter. The evidence that we presented to the Attorney General's office at the request of the agency who had jurisdiction. We did not have jurisdiction in this case. If we did, I don't know if we would have done anything different. Chief Carpenter and I concurred that the best way to move forward was bring an outside law enforcement agency in.
Okay.
We don't have to like it, and we can be upset about it, but it is the rule of law, and we did let this other law enforcement agency investigate this.
All right. And again, that's what it all comes down to, the thousands of dollars of taxpayer dollars that, right, we just don't know about. Okay. Well, let's talk a little bit about some of the recent scams. I think, Skylar, you're kind of following these, that once again, taxpayer residents are kind of being preyed upon?
Yeah, Leslie, you know, this is something that we, at the sheriff's office, we see an influx, and it's kind of random. You know, we'll go weeks and weeks with none, and then it seems like we just get a whole batch, and it's the same sort of scams, you know, folks calling, impersonating sheriff's officials. We've had multiple residents call and say, you know, hey, Sheriff Smith called me and said that I need to, you know, pay X amount in gift cards because I have warrants. So, you know, we're preaching the same thing that we always do. Law enforcement is never going to call you and ask for money over the phone. If that does happen and, you know, you feel more comfortable calling us to verify, definitely do that. But yeah, we're seeing lots of folks fall victim to this.
Yeah. So what's the best thing to do when somebody kind of gets a suspicious call? Just
hang up. Hang up. Yep. That's the easiest thing. You know, these criminals, they're so good at using these fear tactics. And the longer you engage with them, the longer you're on the phone, the more convincing they're going to be. So if you know, as soon as you get that feeling, just hang up and call us, and you know, we'll reassure you that yeah, this was a scam. But yeah, get off the phone with them as quick as you can.
Now, I've also heard it's important to get off the phone quickly and not talk because of just the AI capabilities we have. Once they can record your voice, use that in future scams?
They can, and the advancements are just scary, really. But I've seen, not here locally, but following national news, people are staying on the phone, engaging, having a conversation, and then their voice is then used to scam a family member, right? Because now you've been able to record me for 15 minutes. Well, now an AI-generated phone call can be made to, you know, say my grandmother or my aunt, and it sounds just like me, and they're able to essentially recreate a conversation and now scam my grandma.
Wow. Occasionally, I get something in the mail from the Utah Sheriff's Association, and it's got your name on it, Sheriff Smith. Is that legit?
That is. That's the Utah Sheriff's Association raising funds. They get a percentage of that. It's a third party that does it. But that is legitimate. Ironically, talking about the scams, I just got one where it was a toll booth violation in an email. And I just happened to be in Michigan, and it came from Michigan. And I racked my brain forever. I was like, I never went through a toll booth. Looked into it, and it's all a scam.
Wow. So even the sheriff can get scammed.
Oh, absolutely.
Okay. Any idea how many people fall for this? I'm sure you keep records.
Too many. Mm-hmm. I don't have the numbers right in front of me, but it's a staggering amount. And, you know, one common thing that folks will tell me back when I was taking these reports is I knew, you know, they'll say, I knew something was wrong. I had a feeling something was wrong. But yeah, it's a staggering amount of people.
And the number's probably bigger than we realize because people are embarrassed to admit it. A friend got a call, and it was the same thing. And the person said they were from the sheriff's office. She said, well, I'm friends with the sheriff. I'll three-way him in. And they hung up.
All right. And I was going to ask, I mean, who are the most vulnerable? We often see, you know, the elderly being preyed upon. But, my goodness, when we get the sheriff preyed upon, it's anybody.
It's everybody.
It is. It's everyone. It's all over the board. I've seen young people, I've seen old people, it's everyone.
Yeah, I was going to follow up on that because it seems like we had heard about some inappropriate photos of a minor being being blackmailed. Mm-hmm. Whatever happened? Did you guys able to find the perp here? Or?
So those investigations are so difficult. The vast majority of the time, the criminals that are doing that are operating outside of the country, so well outside of our jurisdiction. So prosecution is incredibly difficult, which is why, as the sheriff's office, we are very heavy on the education. You know, education on internet safety, social media safety, that's what's going to be kind of our saving grace. It's very difficult after it's already happened to track these people down. If we are lucky enough to track them down, prosecuting them is a completely different story, and quite frankly, it's difficult and it doesn't happen.
All right, and certainly another issue I know you guys have been dealing with are those of road rage. Again, what's best practice for that?
Well, you know, again, what we've been preaching is you got to calm down. You know, if you're out driving, calm down, you know, take a minute. Everyone's in a hurry. Even on my way to your studio today, you know, you've got these people weaving in and out of traffic, and it's so frustrating and it's so aggravating. Let them go, you know, call us. We'll attempt to locate the vehicle and we'll deal with it as law enforcement. Don't engage with them though, because you don't know if they've got a gun. You don't know what their frame of mind is. So if everyone just calms down, takes a breath, we'll all get where we're going. We might be a few minutes late. That's okay.
Yeah. Okay. One other issue I wanted to mention was the this year you were scheduled to hire a bunch of new deputies in order to become school resource officers.
That's correct.
That's all been done?
That's all been done. We have them in place. We've done a lot of training. We're doing some training with the Guardians program right now where it's volunteers that will be in the schools. But we should have a deputy, we will have a deputy in every school within Summit County.
All right, and how many did you end up hiring?
I believe it was 9 all total.
Right.
One of those deputies now is on our public lands that the county owns, patrolling those lands, which seems like a great job to me. I would trade with them. but we hired 9. They'll be in every school. And like we've talked about in the past, you know, that's the issue that keeps me up at night. Always trying to figure out how we can stay ahead of any kind of occurrence in our schools. It's a frightening issue to parents, law enforcement, and hopefully this is a step in the right direction.
Yeah, and now, you know, with summer vacation approaching, I mean, what are these deputies do all summer since there's nobody in the schools?
Yeah, they'll be in the patrol division. We'll enhance our patrol division during the summer. So you'll see them more in our subdivisions, our communities. It's a great plus up to help stop the garage burglaries and things like that. We'll have a much greater presence during the summer.
All right, and actually gives the deputies time to take summer vacation too, with more to fill in the spots.
Yeah. It does.
Was that a problem in the past?
It's always a problem. If you know, because we run pretty lean in our patrol division. So if someone's sick while somebody's on vacation, you know, we have to supplement that. So during the summers, you know, we won't have those issues. Instead of saying have 6 patrol deputies out in the evening, we'll have 8 or 10.
Yeah, and budget season approaching here in a couple of months. Anything that you've got your eye on that, you know, you'll be asking for?
Well, you know, as we prepare for the Olympics, you know, we're trying to increase our footprint as far as our patrol division. I think overall, our investigations division has done pretty well. We've leaned heavily on technology. We have the capability right now, and it was as of last week, that we will have a drone as our first responder. So the drone program has grown exponentially. And when we get a call to dispatch, the first thing that will be launched is a drone. So as a deputy's pulling up, they should be getting real-time information, which makes it safer for the deputy and gives us a quicker response on really bad situations.
So who flies the drone?
We have several drone pilots, and now we're going to start training dispatchers to fly them where we can fly them right out of dispatch. But we probably have, well, you're a drone pilot.
Yeah, I would say, we've probably got 9 pilots, and, you know, it's a call-out, you know, type situation, and it's great. We use our drones for, a whole gamut of things. It's a fantastic program, and like the sheriff said, the advancements are incredible, and, you know, to be able to launch a drone and have that be the first response is going to be, it's going to be great, and we're really excited to get it going.
So is that usually the case, that the drone gets there perhaps before the deputy?
That's absolutely the idea, yeah, that's what we're moving towards.
And they kind of then have some capability to see the situation that's happening?
It gives them real-time intelligence, yeah.
Hmm. What are some of the other benefits, I guess, of that?
We use them for all sorts of things. If we have a missing individual, in a neighborhood, say a lost child just recently, I think maybe 2 or 3 weeks ago, we had a missing child. We're able to put that drone up. That drone can cover much more land than a deputy on foot can. So it really is just a force multiplier.
And it helps us where we don't have to call for a helicopter. You know, the state helicopter we've used, and they've been phenomenal. But if we get the drones in the air, we don't need the helicopter.
Did the drone find the child? Or was it a deputy?
In this particular case, I don't think the drone did, but I could name you a dozen others where the drone has actually found the child before our deputies can.
Impressive. Okay. Anything else you'd like to tell us?
You know what? If people can calm down, the road rage is concerning. Mother's Day is coming up. I hope all the moms have a great Mother's Day.
Absolutely.
All right. Frank Smith and Skylar Talbot, thanks so much for your time this
morning.
Thank you, Leslie.
The Heber City Council meets Tuesday starting at 4 o'clock. On the phone with a preview of the meeting is Heber City Manager Matt Brower. Good morning, Matt.
Good morning, Leslie.
So during work session, the council will discuss the TAP project recommendations. How much money is there to award, and how many applicants are recommended for funding?
This year, we have $60,000 available for the TAP grant program. There were 15 applications. 13 were passed through for funding consideration, and my council will hear the recommendations of the TAP committee and make a decision tomorrow night.
Yeah, I noticed that the Wasatch County Senior Center was turned down for money for some craft classes. Why aren't they ineligible? Because the committee did score their project pretty high.
It's my understanding that the request actually encompassed, it was more capital in nature, meaning they had to make some modification to their building, as I understand it. And that's not the intent of Heber's TAP tax program. It was more to actually fund the actual arts directly.
All right. Turning to the budget, we're talking about a no tax increase budget.
The balanced budget I presented to my council at their first budget workshop did not include any property tax increase. The council did not indicate one way or the other at that budget workshop. We have our second budget workshop tomorrow afternoon at 4:30, and we'll continue the conversation.
All right. The council, as you mentioned, just discussed this at last week's meeting. We're talking about an $87 million overall budget. $18 million goes to the general fund, about $38 million budgeted for capital projects. With regard to the operating fund, are we talking about any new full-time employees?
We've included two full-time employees. One would be a detective in our police department, and the second would be in our public works department. So two full-time employees included in the budget.
All right. And any kind of pay and or merit increases budgeted for staff?
Yeah, we programmed a 2.8% COLA, and we're looking at adopting a nine-step program for all the employees citywide. This is a program that would allow them to move from the left side of the grade, if you will, over to the right side in 9 years. This is allowed to be competitive with the other entities that do this, such as Park City, Summit County, Wasatch County, and others.
Yeah, something very similar to what we do with our teachers as well, kind of a step in pay. Yeah,
that's correct.
All right. What did you see with regard to increases in the city's health insurance plans?
We have seen large double-digit increases over the last couple of years. We put it back out to bid, and we're looking at awarding a contract to PEHP. This is a 9.8% percent increase. We're also looking at a contract for 2 years. The first year would be 9.8%. The second year would be 7.2%. That would guarantee us a second year rate that is below what's historically been the average increase, which is above 10%.
Okay, so over those 2 years, though, we're talking about a 17% increase, yeah?
That's correct. And like I said before, previously, we've been seeing up close to 20% increases, having to put the program back out to bid to get lower increases, switch providers, to do anything that we possibly can to keep those costs down.
All right. The capital budget, $38 million, what projects are contemplated for this upcoming fiscal year?
The fiscal year 26 budget entails funding to wrap up a lot of ongoing projects. For example, our Central Heber water and sewer line replacement project will be in its fourth year, and it should wrap up by this October. In fact, we are concluding in fiscal year 26 the largest capital investment in the city's history. So we'll be wrapping many of those projects up. Other projects include the pressurized irrigation system, where we're putting meters on all of our boxes so we can begin monitoring the amount of pressurized water that we deliver. Other projects include wrapping up road projects, the city's Combarium project, the main stage project. And so 26 will be wrapping up the city's largest capital infrastructure investment in history.
Wow. The total budget estimated is about 25% larger than last year's. Is this a typical increase?
The $86 million number you mentioned includes the interfund transfers. If you exclude the interfund transfers, it's a $69.7 million budget, about a 19.4% increase. And the reason it's still a very large budget is, again, the winding up of the very large capital programs. Alone, the Central Heber Water and Sewer Line Replacement Project is a $50 million project. And so we have some very large projects to be wrapping up, and that's one of the largest drivers of that number.
Yeah. All right. And some residents, as you know, have been critical of the city's plans for the Main Street Park, which could cost $23 million if the council implements all of the ideas shared by the consultant. How would you respond to those concerns?
Well, this project of re-envisioning the city's Main Street Park is intended to allow for community building, economic development. It's allowing us to achieve our number one policy priority, which is the transformation of our downtown into a destination, take advantage of the forthcoming Olympics, the bypass, which we believe will be constructed prior to the Olympics, and of course, the Deer Valley East Village, which we believe will be also a game changer for us. For Heber City and the City Council, the transformation of the downtown is something that will benefit our locals as well as visitors. It will generate additional sales tax revenues, which will reduce the upward pressure on property taxes. And it'll also allow for a greater quality of life for those that want to come downtown to enjoy the new amenities and participate in what we have going on.
And the goal has been to have the new bandshell finished in time for the summer concert season. Is construction on track for that?
It is not, admittedly. It is behind, but we had a project meeting Thursday of last week. We are told that the band shell itself will be done in the next week and a half. The Festival Street, which is 200 South, which sits adjacent to the new main stage, we're told to be done in about 2 weeks itself. So although it's behind schedule, we're confident that will be done before our summer Heber Market on Main concert series kicks off on June 5th.
Okay, let's see. Tomorrow's agenda also includes considering an ordinance for the city to collect fees in lieu for affordable housing rather than the Wasatch County Housing Authority. What's the reason for this potential change?
Heber City is interested in undertaking some affordable housing projects itself. So rather than obligate the money to the county's Affordable Housing Board, Heber City simply wants to maintain the option of investing some of that money in its own affordable housing projects. For example, our downtown CRA, Community Investment Agency, we're required to invest 10% of those tax increment funds into affordable housing. So for us, it makes sense to maybe work together with our CRA agency to make affordable housing investments. So it's really about preserving the city's option of perhaps investing that money differently and engaging in different affordable housing projects.
Okay, and how would it change the city's approach to creating affordable housing?
Heber City is looking at working with existing developers to monetize their affordable housing obligations and maybe move them closer to town where there's schools, there's more shopping, more transportation options. And so we're looking at how we can move many of the obligations currently negotiated in development agreements into the downtown area where they can be better served.
Okay, and how much of a fee are we talking about?
It depends on the existing master development agreement and what we're able to negotiate with the developer, how we monetize it. So although we don't know currently the exact amount, we are looking at potentially negotiating or monetizing those development agreements so that we can move those resources to the downtown area to partner with developers and hopefully pull off some great affordable housing projects ourselves.
Okay. Let's see. It seems like Park City and Summit County have found that the fee in lieu that they have in place isn't enough to actually build anything. But it seemed like if they had tried to change it, they would lose the requirement that they have 10 or 15% of all new development units must be affordable. So does Heber have that kind of requirement?
We do. The state legislature, as you probably know, did away with that requirement a couple of legislative sessions ago. We are able to negotiate that requirement into annexation agreements. These are voluntary agreements. The developers can negotiate with the city for those types of fee in lieu amounts. And so every annexation agreement since approximately 2022 has this 10% fee in lieu requirement in it, or an option to build the affordable housing units.
Okay, so changing this ordinance, you don't risk losing that
No.
minimum development?
Absolutely not. That's a negotiated obligation that we're going to negotiate away.
Okay. Let's see, the council will consider an annexation request from Red Rock for some 31 acres of industrial land. What's the staff recommendation on this?
Staff's recommendation is to approve this. This is 31 acres located to the south of town. It's an existing business, a very successful business. They're looking to have city resources via the annexation. The question is about a future roadway that will run through the property and the timing of that roadway. Staff certainly supports this. It makes sense to bring it into the city.
All right. And speaking of annexations, the primary sponsor of the Riverview Town, Mark Wilson, said he wants to incorporate to avoid annexation without representation. So does Heber have any intention of annexing more of the Northfields region?
So Heber City currently has what's referred to as a MOU, or a Memorandum of Understanding, with Wasatch County, that Heber City would not annex anything more into the Northfields area. The Harvest Village, which is in that northern tip, was in the MOU and is identified as part of our North Village area. That's why it was annexed by the city, because it was previously approved as part of the North Village area. The city has no designs on annexing the Northfields, has no intentions to. In fact, it's not even in the city's annexation policy plan, as when we intend to honor the MOU executed with Wasatch County back in 2018.
So what are the city's long-term plans for annexation?
Actually, you probably won't see a lot more annexation happening. You'll see a couple infill parcels in the North Village area, but you won't see a lot of annexation happening the next few years.
All right. Heber also preparing for Unity Week. At one point, I think it was considered Pride Week. Heber City even flew Pride banners up and down Main Street, so that's over forever, as long as we've got the new legislation intact.
Well, Unity Week now has been in place for about 5 years. We have events all week long that's intended to unify our community. For example, during the week of June 2nd through I think it's June 9th, we'll have dumpsters placed at all of our main city parks for the public to place in there. They're social and another event which we're defining. And so the event is intended to unify our community, to bring them together around this week and do some fun things.
All right. Is there any appetite for the Heber Council to add an event or otherwise show support for the LGBTQ community?
I don't know. We've not had any recent requests. My council is intended this week to be focused on the entire community, not simply one group or another. And so I think if the request is revolving around bringing the entire community together, they'd probably consider it.
All right. Also, the council will hold two public hearings for, hold a public hearing for two PIDs. For the recently approved Harvest Village development along North US 40. What is a PID? And again, I believe it's just no impact to taxpayers, right?
That is correct. It's no impact to existing taxpayers. A PID, a public improvement district, is essentially a financial tool the state legislature approved three or four legislative sessions ago. It's intended to serve as a financing tool for the developer is able to access cheaper financing to complete a lot of the more system improvements earlier, such as the main roads and trail systems. And it's also intended to provide some improvements for the developments occupants who will buy into the project later. For example, in our Jordanelle Ridge PID, we put some money aside for a clubhouse, for an outdoor amphitheater, so that those who are paying for the PID can actually benefit from it. And you'll see a similar strategy with the Harvest Village PIDs.
Yeah, they're right next to each other. So why are there two? Why not just one large one?
I couldn't tell you that. That is the discretion of the developer to request one or two. Typically, it comes down to timing. It's limits on how large the financing can be that might require them to do two. It's also the timing. They may only have certain phases ready to go, and they'll tie the PIDs to those phases. So generally, it's an issue of timing as well as limits on how much they can finance.
Okay, Matt, anything else you wanted to tell us?
Yeah, just a gentle reminder about Unity Week, about Hebrew Market on Main kicking off on June 5th. This is our 27th season and expect it to be bigger than ever with our new main stage. That'll be ready.
Okay, Matt Brower, Heber City City Manager, thanks so much for your time.
Leslie, thank you.
Well, on Wednesday at 7 o'clock, Park City Film will screen a new film by Utah director and producer Raman Hauser. It's called Thaw, The Future of Fertility is on Ice. The screening will be preceded with a networking social from 5 to 7 p.m. and then followed by a moderated panel. On the phone with details, I have the director of the film, Raman Hauser, along with the CEO of She Money, Madison Lemansky. Good morning to both of you, ladies.
Good morning, Leslie.
Good morning.
Raman, let's start with you and just have you tell us a little bit about your film.
Yeah, I'm delighted. We had the world premiere last night in California to rave reviews, so that's always exciting. I came to the understanding that a lot of women are living in silos as they deal with infertility, especially because women are choosing to have babies later in life, and that it's quite a big issue. And there was the assumption that, well, women are delaying motherhood because they're pursuing higher degrees in education, or they're trying to seek partnership and in their careers. But in fact, most women are freezing their eggs because of partnership issues. They're actually having a hard time finding men that are, as Marcia Inhorn, our expert in the film, says, that are eligible, equal, and educated. So it's a really complex societal issue.
Hmm. How did you find the women that you followed during the film?
Well, a lot of research. I have an amazing team, and we began to dig through articles, and of course the internet helps with some of this, and we were able to look into women who represented different reasons for freezing. All of these are non-medical reasons, right? These are all elective egg freezers. Some, in fact, created embryos. They had partners with whom they wanted to parent, but they just weren't ready for whether it's, economic reasons or social reasons or career reasons. But most of the women hadn't found, a partner yet. So we just did a lot of research, and then it was convincing these women that they could tell their story in an honest and open way. I'm grateful to them because we really wouldn't have this film without their willingness to share.
Yeah, certainly the common denominator for all three is producing, right, a viable frozen embryo. How different are their stories? Just different circumstances about why they wanted to do that?
Yeah, I thought it's most interesting in a film to show different reasons and different stories for wanting to create embryos or freeze their eggs. That way the audience had a better opportunity to relate to the different situations that these women were going through. That was important. We do have Caroline Gleick, who's a Park City local. She and her husband Rob are just not ready yet. They know that they in their case, of course, they have found an amazing partnership, but they're just not sure that they're ready, especially because Caroline is in a very physical career. She's an extreme mountaineer, and she would have to really take time out of her career in order to have a child. So they're trying to decide whether or not that's actually right for them. But this gives them the opportunity to have children in the future with her younger eggs.
Yeah. Now, what did you find most surprising as you made the film?
Without a doubt, it was this mating gap idea. I've worked hard over the last 12 years to make films about female empowerment, and I think so many of us have really been focused on empowering women. And this is the first time that I've come to the realization that there might be an unintended, circumstance from this female empowerment, that women are now, there are 27% more women in colleges than there are men. Women are becoming so accomplished that they're having a hard time finding partners that they want to couple up with. In other words, we're used to something in our society called hypergamy, which is where it's fairly common for a woman to marry up. It's less common for a woman to marry down, say, to somebody who maybe doesn't make as much money, isn't as well educated. So we're at a really interesting point in our society where women aren't really, there isn't as much choice out there for women who are highly accomplished.
Interesting. I want to talk a little bit to Madison. You're with She Money. So how was She Money involved with all of this?
Yes, good morning, Leslie, and hi, Robin. She Money is really passionate about supporting our community members in really improving their financial wellness. And so we know that there's such a financial impact to IVF treatments and to this whole process, not just the initial treatments, but to actually follow through and produce a child using these frozen eggs is very costly. And so we're thrilled to partner with Robin. We screened a film of hers, Savvy, which I also can't recommend enough, a couple of years ago. Thrilled to partner with Robin to gather in community around this topic. We believe in the power of social capital to support financial wellness. And so we host quarterly socials to gather community together and get the chance to build friendship with one another and to have an honest space to discuss these issues.
All right. So tell us what's happening at the reception. Again, as I mentioned, it's 5 to 7 p.m.
That's right. Yeah, so we'll be hosting our social just in advance of the film from 5 to 7 at the Jim Santee Auditorium at the Park City Library. We're thrilled to be partnered with Park City Film. We're grateful to our sponsors, Comcast, NBC Universal, and Northwestern Mutual. We have a couple of amazing women traveling in, Nikki McDonald and Helena Rosenthal from Northwestern Mutual, who also have their own experience with these issues and want to be there to support women and to consider the financial implications of this process.
All right. There is a $15 fee to watch the film. And if you want to be part of the reception, it's a $30 cost just to pay for, I guess, the munchies there.
Exactly. Yes. And please join us. We have a really vibrant community, you know, women and men from all different industries come together. And it's really a beautiful opportunity to gather with like-minded folks.
Okay. Robin, I wanted to ask you, I know that you're just getting this film off the ground, but have you got ideas for what's next?
Oh, Leslie, if you can find me a funder to make a new film, then I'll be all over making another one. But in this economic environment, it's so hard to get these films made. I am just delighted and so relieved to have this film, 86 impactful minutes, reaching the big screen right now. So I'm just focusing on distribution for this, and then I'll think further into the future. Maybe I need to look into why, you know, the demise of, sadly, you know, I have a son myself, but why young men aren't rising to the top as much anymore. I'm careful how I say that, but I'm concerned about our young men in our society.
Yeah. So, yeah, I mean, you've got a half dozen documentary films that have been made, and it's just like, Where do they go? I mean, do they eventually get out onto the streaming platforms? Is that what happens?
Yeah, everyone's different. I do have three films up on Amazon, Amazon Prime Video. So you can see my film Bias, my film Running for Jim, and Code Debugging the Gender Gap. Code and Bias both screened at the Park City Library and Jim Santee Auditorium. So those are there. Savvy is still on my website. There's a donation fee that goes to my nonprofit. But I'm just going to do a lot of private screenings with this. I've got some screenings coming up. You can keep an eye on my website, finishlinefeaturefilms.com. We're going to be doing a screening in Santa Barbara. We're doing a screening on Long Beach Island with part of Lighthouse Film Festival. So we've got some film festivals coming up, and these are ever evolving. But yes, eventually I'd like to get this up on streaming one way or another.
Okay. All right. It's parkcityfilm.org for people to purchase tickets, again, both to the reception and the film itself. And again, you mentioned yourself and Caroline Gleick. And who else will be part of that panel?
Jackie Zehner, who is head of She Money. Yeah, we'll be there. Go ahead, Madison.
Oh, no. You were saying the same thing I was. Yes, we're thrilled to have executive producers of the film, Geralyn Dreyfuss and Jackie Zehner, involved as well, Park City locals all around.
Okay, I've got to leave it there. Ladies, thanks so much, and good luck with the film there, Robin.
Thanks, Leslie. Really appreciate it.